The brothers Wiss. The brothers Wiss, brothers Wiss. The brothers Wiss. The brothers.
You're now listening to Greg. It's the Brothers Wisp. Let's take
Hey, everybody. This is Greg with a special Brothers Wisp. This one in particular is all about sonar and the man behind it. So this go around, we have a couple of, well, we've got one familiar face, Mike Hammett from Chicagoland.
How's it going?
We've got
same thing every time.
Same thing every time.
It's going to be my consistent line.
I love it. Chad Walks. Where are you from, Chad?
Originally from Chicago, but I'm out of Golden, Colorado now, home of Coors Brewing.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Everything's legal there now, right?
Just about everything is legal, yeah. You want it, we got it.
Excellent. Excellent. And we also have Simon Westlake, the man himself.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Excellent. Well, this was a bit of a surprise, Simon. You reached out of the blue and said, hey, you think it would be interesting to have a podcast? And I said, absolutely. So I opened it up to our guys on the inside of our patron Slack account there. And these guys aggregated a whole lot of questions. And we added a voting system in there, right? So there's some that are upvoted more than others. And you said you were kind enough to answer any and all questions. So I'm going to start with, what's your favorite color? And why is it pink?
Well, my favorite color is pink because it actually used to be the most masculine color. Did you know that?
I didn't know. Actually, it's my favorite color. Some people prefer to call it salmon, but I'm not afraid of it. I like pink.
They used to dress, I don't remember how long ago, this was a very long time ago, I think, but they used to dress boys in pink because it was related to red, the color of blood. And there was some, I don't remember the whole story, but sometime, probably a little before our birthdays, but it sort of got flipped around. But yeah, if anyone ever gives you crap about wearing pink, you tell them. It's the color of strong blood or something like that.
So a man that can think on his feet, I love it. You're ready to go with that. Excellent. So I guess probably first things first, tell us honestly, what's, in your opinion, what is sonar? How'd you guys get started, and where do you see yourself going?
Here's
the elevator pitch.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm not very good at elevator pitches. It's thankfully why I've gone to hire some salespeople, but I'll give you the spiel. So we started Sonar, I guess it's been almost 6 years ago now, and it's a billing and OSS platform, I guess is how most people describe it, but I kind of think the whole OSS terminology has become a bit outdated, right? There's so many different things that different platforms are doing out there. It's kind of tough to know what that really means anymore. But that's kind of where it fits, and really started it because I've been in the ISP industry now for 20 years, something like that, 21 years. Spent the first 9 or 10 years or so at Time Warner, and then came over to the Wisp side after that. And I think in my time between being at Time Warner and seeing what Wisps are doing, the one constant between them all was lack of good software to help them do what they needed to do. We struggled with it at Time Warner, still so struggles with that in the Wisp industry, and I think small ISPs in general, right? I mean, Wisps aren't really doing a lot of things that are that much different. The delivery is different, right? But I think the concept's the same. And so I've spent the last 10 years ago doing a variety of things to try and help solve that, and Sonar was the most recent step along that path.
So is it something you started building in-house and you thought, hey, other folks would want to use this, or was the idea from the ground up?
No. Yeah, for sure. No, ground up, yeah. I think it's sort of interesting in this scene, I think, that a lot of the platforms that are out there, maybe all of them at this point, I'm not sure, but at least the vast majority of them, the pitch they have, or the truth they have at least, is it was something they built in-house and thought it would be something maybe others could use. But I think the struggle with that a lot of the time is that if you're going to build something in-house, you're really building it to meet your direct needs. I'm not going to build something in-house and worry about what everyone else is doing, right? That's not a big concern. And so I think that's one of the flaws with a lot of platforms out there, really. It's very often dictated to what the needs were of the ISP that was building it. There's actually a big ISP up in Canada that's pretty close to Glen, one of my business partners, and they have an in-house system they built. They're about 25,000-30,000 subs, and name escapes me, but I don't know. But anyway, they built a big in-house system, and I mean, it's incredible, all the stuff they've tied in, but it's all super specific, right? It only works with the gear they use, it only works with the vehicle tracking they use, and I think it's, you know, a lot more achievable to build something when you're really only worrying about what you need. And that's not really what we try to do with Sonar. I mean, I didn't have a Wisp at the time, and we didn't start using it for Glenn's Wisp. I went wireless for, I don't know, a year, maybe after we started building it, maybe a bit more than that. I don't remember anymore, but, you know, we were really just focused on how can we build the best thing we can and make something scalable and something that everyone can use. And it's a tricky challenge, but that's been the target.
Gotcha. So, I mean, you talked about a juxtaposition between in-house, where you're very specific, right? This is going to meet my needs, and this is all of the things I use. So, Sonar, you tried to be more flexible. What are some of the challenges you had with trying to incorporate that flexibility?
Well, where do I begin, I guess? The sort of easy and obvious answer to that is people are using so much stuff, right? Different vendors, different systems, whatever, and to try and support all of those and do it in a pretty abstract way so that you're not just integrating it in a very shallow way, right? We try to integrate things so that people can use them in a variety of ways. I think we could talk a bit about things like the MikroTik integration later. That's, I think, a good example of that. But that's the first challenge, really, is often somebody will come to us and say, can you integrate X? And it's not just the integration that's tough, it's figuring out how to integrate it again so it's useful to everyone, right? Not just the one person who wants it in a certain way. I think the other big one is really trying to separate the needs that people have away from the solutions that they're looking for, and trying to sort of bridge that gap by, again, thinking about how everyone's going to use something. Like, we sort of have this, it's almost a joke in-house now at this point because I say it so much, but other staff members come to me, or, you know, other people in Sonar all the time, and say, this customer wants this feature. And it's almost like a broken record of, don't tell me what they want, but tell me what the problem is. Hmm. Because you sort of end up, when you're only looking at the solutions people want, with just a very complex piece of software with a lot of different buttons and knobs and stuff, right? Or you implement something in a very rigid way because you're just meeting that specific need. And I think that's the hard thing often, is really digging down to the core problem somebody's having and helping come up with a good solution for that can also work for other people.
I think when you're buried inside a problem trying to solve it in your own company, you see the path to the end of that, and you're not, at least we weren't, very open to other ideas. And one of the things I loved about Sonar when we started off, we came over with the Wispmon acquisition. We had just kind of started going through their onboarding. So we were still new in software like this, and I started watching the casts. And that is what sort of really guided us to how we now deploy and manage our network, where we thought we knew how we wanted to get to the end goal of managing things, and then started watching the cast and thought, oh, there's a whole different way to skin this cat, and this actually makes a whole lot of sense to us. And now you're responsible for really the reason we do a lot of the things that we do and a lot of our deployment. It's because we watch those casts and said, yeah, this makes sense, and I can deploy this because I can follow Simon here in this video and pause it for a second, go program my MikroTik, come back, see if that worked. Okay, play the video some more. Okay, that didn't work. And, you know, kind of beat yourself through that. And that was one of the things I'm hoping that I see kind of continue as you begin to roll out V2, is continuing those casts, because they were, at least from our standpoint, very useful in kind of opening our eyes to different ways of solving things.
Yeah, it'd be good to, if you haven't already, go check them out, because we put them off for quite a long time because we didn't want to build them and be changing them. And also, I kept saying that I felt like I needed to do them again, that, you know, I knew the system well enough and it made more sense for me to do it. And everyone ignored me, thankfully, and we hired some really good people, like some amazing video editors and people to do voiceovers and stuff. And I was watching some of them the other day, and it blows my mind all the time. I look at stuff like that, and I'm like, I work at this company? Like, this is the kind of quality of stuff we're putting out now. It's really great. That team's done a fantastic job, and I think we have, I don't know, 50, 60, maybe more casts out there now, and they've chopped them down into much smaller pieces. But I think the thing that we've kept trying to do, and hopefully this is what you saw when you watched the other ones, is not really make these videos in this documentation where it says, okay, click this button and click this button. It's more, here's how something functions, and here's different ways you can use it, and knowledge sharing, right, rather than just kind of paint by numbers type of stuff, because that's really what I think is valuable to people, is, you know, help educate somebody about different options, but still let them pick the right one for them.
It's interesting. I was wholly unfamiliar with these casts, so I'm assuming that little bite size, just pieces of information, how you do this in the system, how you do that, maybe some design tips, tricks. What kind of stuff are we talking about?
Yeah. I mean, it was a mix. You know, now there's all kinds of stuff now that it's not just me doing them. But when I built the original ones, it was a mix of here's a new feature we built or a new module or whatever, and here's how it works, and here's how you can do specific things with it. So an example would be, I think when we launched the ticketing, here's how to get inbound emails to come into your ticketing system, right? Or here's how to do this or that. But yeah, there were other more design type ones. Like, I did one about how you could use the address list system in Sonar with Microtix to do rate limiting in a couple of different ways, or how you could redirect people, or I think I did one on getting PPPoE working with Radius and stuff like that. And it wasn't so much, here's where you can go from nothing to this complete solution. It was more, here's pieces, right, and you can look at them all and see what makes sense to you and plug them together. And yeah, I really, most of them, I, you know, I'd be sitting here and thinking what would be useful for people to see, and how can I squeeze that into a 10-15 minute video at the most.
I would take issue with the fact that they weren't, you know, beginning to end feature implementation, because when we sat down to decide how are we going to authenticate customers, I talked to a lot of Wisps around us, and many of them are like, yeah, we don't. You know, we'll put up some shapers on the radio and just kind of let that happen. I said, all right, well, what do you do when you need to find out what their IP address is, because you get a takedown order? Yeah, we don't really have that ability. I thought, well, that's not scalable for us, and we were new enough that I thought, well, let's do this right. So we sat down, watched the casts on that, and we ended up choosing. I didn't want to go PPPoE at that point, because I want something that's simpler for my customers. I want them to buy any router off the shelf, be able to deploy it in the network. And so watched the cast on option 82. And from that and a couple associated casts with that, we were able to implement option 82 from scratch with no previous knowledge on it. And I think with very little input from your support staff, which is the point of the casts, really, right, is to take that load off your support staff for all these kind of frequently asked questions and say, hey, watch this. And if you got some specific questions, come back. But it really did walk us through from the beginning to the end. And when I started the Wisp 5 years ago, I was not a networking guy. I came from a whole different background. And so it really was geared, I think, to your market, which I'm guessing is the small to medium Wisp. The big guys have probably got a system in place, an in-house system that they've built, but I think your niche is really the little guys and the medium-sized guys that are moving from a Excel spreadsheet to something that's a little bit more more mature.
Yeah, it's kind of a mix now, and I think just to sort of circle back to something you said before, I think that was the point of the casts to a degree. And a lot of why I built them in the beginning was we bootstrapped Sonar ourselves. We didn't have a bunch of VC money or whatever, right? We didn't have any money really. And so all the pieces that I was thinking about, like support, that we really had to try to be able to minimize, right? I mean, I had one person answering the phone for a long time. Building the casts was really first and foremost a way to help do that, that I could get this information out to a lot of people without me having to pick up 100 calls. But it was also because I think from the way I work, it made sense. In that, like for me today, if I want to go learn something new, I don't really look for someone to talk to. I Google it, right, and start reading articles and watching videos. But that isn't really true for everyone, and so it was a good fit for people that like to learn that way, and I think it still is. But, you know, we've really pivoted more into having, I mean, we have a big group of people doing support now. We have a success team that helps people, and I think that's the thing I really had to learn is, people learn differently, you know, people are looking for a different kind of approach to that. And so we're maintaining the casts, but I'd say more so than trying to limit support, it's more just providing that entry point for people like me, you know, and then having the success support people around to support everyone else.
You know, something that Chad kind of touched on, which is curious to me, is what do you consider your ideal customer? Like, if you were trying to nail it down, who do you think is the perfect customer for Sonar?
Yeah, that's a tough question nowadays. I mean, it depends on your perspective, I suppose. Are you the perfect customer in terms of the platform being the best fit for them, or like what's the best profit margin for us or whatever, right? You know, there's different answers.
When I was in the data center business, we said our ideal customer was one that paid the bills on time.
So. Yeah, and doesn't call you too much, right? I guess that's probably true for almost every business out there. But
sometimes it's hard, right? It's like, so you probably have a mix of very small, very large, very independent, very needy. I mean, it's just probably all over the shop, right?
Yeah, and I think what we've learned again as the company's grown is that there are different personalities and there are different business models and stuff, but by and large, you know, those customers you look at and they seem to be more needy than others, often you're not really meeting some need, right? Like they're frustrated because of a lack of whatever, right? Like reporting's a big issue for us in V1 and something we've spent a lot of time working on in V2. And, you know, that was something that drove a lot of calls. And if you just look at those numbers, you're like, okay, well, this customers calling us 4 times a week, right? But it's really because we hadn't provided the tools to them to do what they needed. I think to directly answer what a perfect customer is, I would say it's really more about where they fit into the sort of scale and scope of what we're doing. I mean, a very tiny customer is a great fit for us because we can do a lot for them, and the cost to get in is pretty low for them, as long as they have some level of independence or ability to do some stuff on their own, right? I mean, we don't really have the resources to hold somebody's hand through everything at the very low end. And I think, you know, like to Chad's point, he was able to go and watch some of those casts and look at other things and get up and running. And, you know, that works great for us. I think on the, you know, the flip side of that, very big customers fit well as long as they have the willingness to potentially make some changes. And that can be the tricky thing sometimes with the very large providers as they come in. And when I say very large, I mean, you know, we don't have anyone like Verizon or anyone using Sonar, but more in that sort of tens of thousands of subscribers kind of range. You know, what challenges us there mostly is either they have some fixed process that really doesn't make any sense and they know it doesn't, but it's too hard to change. Or, you know, the other thing that can be challenging there is just sort of getting through to the right people. It can be a pretty opaque structure in big businesses like that. But, I mean, the core is really just getting somebody in a company that sees the value in Sonar and getting a good connection with them to get stuff set up. And, I mean, that's having that makes somebody perfect customer, really, as paying the bill as well, you know.
It's always helpful.
you mentioned you've kind of pivoted to having people contact your support staff, and that's been, I think, an obvious change as a customer really since the launch of V2. And it was one of the kind of upvoted questions that popped up in our Slack is what was the drive behind that? And it can often come with two different, you can perceive that two different ways. One of them is, look, we want you to talk to our staff because we want to help you. And the other is, well, we don't want to publicly announce what we're going to tell you privately, and we don't want to announce roadmaps and feature sets and whatnot. And so it was, I think, really along the lines of those of you that are version one customers, when you have questions about version two or want to see where you might fit in that migration, call our support staff, because it's not going to be, those answers aren't going to be publicly available. And so talk a little bit about what that reasoning was with you about why you were pushing people towards that support call, which some of us, me personally, look at contacting support like that's my last resort. When I send an email to support@xcompany.com or try to call them, I've exhausted every other method I can find because I don't want to be wasting that company's time. That's how I look at that. But I think you guys look at that through a different lens.
I don't know that that's completely true. I mean, I'll say in response to your last point, I agree with you. I mean, if I reach out to support with a company, I'm not looking forward to it. You know, it sort of offends my sense of efficiency most of the time, but
right.
I couldn't figure it out or I couldn't just get a quick answer. And we have discussions about this internally quite a lot, that we don't have things like live chat right now that I really want us to have. It's getting everything set up to be able to do it. But I mean, all the vendors that we spend money with, if they've got a live chat and I can just ask some quick, I'm never going to call a company, you know, like, unless the world's ending or something, is some enormous issue I got to get help with. But I think with the V2 stuff, it's not really about hiding anything. It's that the struggle with it has been, and the ongoing challenge with it is that the answers to the questions are often not that simple. You know, there's a lot of moving parts to getting somebody moved on to V2 from a feature parity perspective, from a migration training perspective, and everything else. And so, you know, the lesson I think we've learned in it is we need to figure out a way to be more open with people in the sense that they don't feel that we're hiding something or that we don't want to publicize something. And we also need to figure out a way to be able to give in-depth enough answers to people that they don't misunderstand the situation. I mean, that's really been, honestly, it's the biggest thing that frustrates me with this whole migration, is that there's just a lot of misinformation flying around out there and people are confused about stuff. And I mean, that's our fault, you know. I'm not blaming anybody else, but I wish we'd figured out a better path to getting stuff out there. And that's a lot of that is what's driven us to build up this success organization and everything else inside Sonar, to be able to reach out to people and work with them directly and square that away. And I mean, hopefully once we're past this V2 migration piece, it'll all be in the past. And my goal right now is to never have to do anything like this again. So and it's a short-term thing.
We shouldn't ask questions about V3 just yet.
Well, I'll tell you, if there is a V3, it won't be, you know, it'll be a seamless transition. And the V1 to V2 thing, you know, it's just V2 is what we really wanted to build in the beginning, and it just wasn't the time and the resources to do it. And a lot of stuff changed between building V1 and building V2, and, you know, it was a long story there. We could probably take up the whole time this podcast talking about. But I think now that we have the architecture that we have, yeah, I mean, anything moving forward is not going to be anywhere near as painful as this has been.
You kind of had your V2 coming out party at Wispapalooza 2019, right? And with
something like that, yeah.
with hindsight being 2020, looking back, are you where you thought you would be at this point? Are you further along? Are you not quite as far along as you thought you were going to be when you had that launch party?
Well, I think with my developer hat on, anytime you ask a developer how long something's going to take, their estimation's about, you know, 10 times less than reality. So I think we're probably nowhere near as far along as I thought we were going to be from the perspective of me working on it. But I think what we really screwed up on there was, in our mind, when I talk about Sonar as a whole, we understood what V2 sort of quote-unquote being ready meant, right? It meant we had some minimum quantity of features that meant we could move a subset of customers over. And I don't think we communicated that very well. And so people went away thinking, like, everything's done, it's completely finished. And they still sort of run into that today, right? I'll talk to people and they say, Christ, V2's never coming out. And I'm like, we got hundreds of people running on it already. It's not like it's still this thing that's, awaiting to release. But yeah, this transition period, I think, has taught me a lot about more clear communication. And I mean, it's still something we're working through today, but that's really what that was. I mean, we were excited to talk about it and show it, and I think people were excited to see it, but it is one of those things where, I look at what other companies do, and you announce stuff early and not everyone can get on it, and maybe it's a negative in some ways. We should have thought about that, but yeah.
You know, it seems like, just looking at the list of stuff, most of it centers around kind of that version 1.2 transition, right? So some of the real questions were, about a roadmap. And so the thinking there, at least it seems, is if you have a roadmap up there of all the different features, maybe you could give folks the ability to kind of, vote on feature priority. So maybe shift things around for you guys. I was curious, how do you prioritize what features? Because I know there's not 100% feature parity between version 1 and 2 yet, right? So how do you prioritize which things to push to the forefront or versus?
It's a mix, I'll say. So we've gotten better at it. I mean, this is something that we've been working on over time to improve. And over the last 6 to 9 months or so, we've been hiring project managers and various other people to help make this work better. Because historically, we built Sonar, it was me and Devin, right? Two developers just hacking away all day in our basements. And so things got finished when they were finished. And what we did next was what we were excited about. And I think, that worked well in a lot of ways back then, because I would talk to somebody at a show and think, oh, that's a great idea. And I'd go knock it out. And then they're really excited and somebody else sees it. Maybe they're excited. But as the user base grows, obviously that doesn't scale very well anymore. And so we had some PMs come in and, hired a bunch more devs and that kind of thing. And I would say the first step really of the roadmap we have in place is we look at what do we need to do to get V2 up to feature parity, right? All those things are our priorities. And then the easy place to start is just looking at each one of those features, looking at our V1 user base and just seeing how many people are using a feature, right? If half of the customer base is using something and 1% is using another feature, we'll focus on the 50% one first. And that's what drives the first part of it. And then from there, it gets filtered and moved around based on a couple of factors, really. I think one is the complexity of it and who's available to work on it. And the other one is there's a couple of features, like voice billing, I think is one of the notable ones, where we knew we wanted to change it significantly, that the implementation that was in V1 was not something I was happy with. And so that can sort of move it around on the roadmap, because maybe the new implementation we're working on is a lot more complex or, reliant on some other feature being finished first or that kind of thing. I think we do use a feature tracking tool in V2 that people that are using V2 already have access to and they can vote on. But the tough thing with that, honestly, is, we want feedback from users in the community, and we take it through there and we do track it and talk about it every week and look through it. But the trouble with a roadmap based on that is it just changes so much, right? Like if we look at that and say, okay, our plan is to start on this feature and then we're going to do this one, by the time you get to do the next one, you know, six things may have shifted around. And it, that wasn't such a big deal when it was really just me, right? I can, you can be pretty agile doing that, but when you've got 20, 30 developers working on stuff, just sort of continually changing the direction of the wagon can be tricky. And I think we still do pretty good at being fairly nimble on that, but it does make things a little bit more difficult. I have started sharing the roadmap, though. I send an email out like once, twice a month, something like that, and we've included some of that data in there. But I mean, frankly, it still changes quite a bit, and so I'm reluctant to be too open with it because I don't want to tell people we're going to do this 3 months from now and then, you know, things change and it gets moved around. But we'll keep getting better about communicating that and figuring out how we can share more info on it for sure.
Do you have a group of, let's call them beta tester customers, that when you want to roll out a new feature, something like the voice billing, that you can turn to them and say, hey, bang away at this, you know, for a month or so and give us some feedback before we flip the switch?
No, not in that sense. So I'm reluctant to do that, because the problem I think with that, well, it depends how you look at it, I guess. Let me step back from that. If you look at it from a beta test perspective, in the sense that we're going to give you something that we're not sure if it's right and see if it works, as time's gone on, I've found the number of customers that actually want to do that is slim. Like, most people are running a business, right? They don't have time to test your stuff for you and figure it out. And generally, what ends up happening when you have a program like that is people say, I want to test it, but what they really mean is, I want it right now and I don't want to wait for it to be finished. And so you end up in this tricky scenario, right, where you've given somebody something that may not be ready, and now they're relying on it, they're trying to run their business on it. And conversely, really, if I said to you, we'll let you use it, but, you know, don't use it to run your business, don't do anything critical on it, I mean, you got to be pretty excited about Sonar to sit there and just play with stuff for the hell of it, right? And like, everyone's got better stuff to do. So what we're moving towards, and we're not quite there yet, but I'm hopeful we'll get there before too long, is more of a feature flag type of system where we can have something like, using voice billing as an example, we can have something where we're confident it works, right? It's gone through testing, it's gone through QA, it's not a beta product, but there might be something missing in it, or there might be, I guess, from more of a functionality perspective, right? Maybe we made some decision that maybe doesn't completely make sense, or we missed some little thing or whatever. And so somebody that does want to use it and they understand they're going to be giving some feedback and we're going to be taking that and using it to tweak it, we can then turn that feature on and give them access to it. And I think that's more the model we want to be in, where we're giving you something we're confident in, but, you know, we're looking for feedback on the functionality of it and that kind of thing. And really the only reason we haven't done that yet is it increases the complexity of the software pretty heavily when we now have all these different pieces that could get turned on and off. You have to make sure you're building something that can handle every combination of things being on or off. But that's where I want to get to, because I think it's helpful to everyone. It helps us really hone big complex things we're building, and it also lets us, when we have some of those sort of customers that we're close with, you know, lets us expose them to it and get some feedback before we roll it out to everyone.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, kind of in that vein, you know, sitting here as a user of a couple different, or, you know, features of V1, where, you know, you have stated, you know, I don't like how this works at all, we're totally redoing it in V2. It is, you know, I look at it as kind of like a, well, gee, I hope they don't take forever to make it. And then it still doesn't solve the underlying problem.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, it's kind of a selfish thing too. But then it's like, you know, I don't want you to waste 3 months building what you think is great, only to find out that no, this doesn't do anything. I mean, you click the button and it does what you says the button does, but that's not what I want it to do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, finding some sort of balance there of getting enough, you know, feedback before you make the product, and then, okay, now walk away for a few months while we work on it, and then come back.
Yeah. So that's something where there's a big gap, I think, between some features and others, right? The stuff that I've built in Sonar and now that the whole team's built as we move forward, where it was very clear to me what the right way was to do it and the wrong way. And then there was other things where I didn't necessarily have the depth of knowledge. And I think voice billing is a good example of that, right? We went and did a bunch of reading about it, but there were things we missed where there wasn't enough data gathered before we built the first time around. And actually what we've started doing to help solve this is we have that feature request system in V2 that helps us track what people are looking for and reach out to them. But we actually hired a guy named Rick who worked at a WISP up in Canada that I'm going to acquire by somebody, Explornet, I think, or one of those big players up there. But anyway, they got acquired and he was looking for another job and he came over to work for Sonar. And the role we've put him in is a lot like what you're talking about. So if we're looking for a new feature or we're looking at some feature request that somebody's made, he'll go out and meet with the users and talk through with them what their needs are, what the problems are, all that kind of stuff. And then if it's the integration of something, he'll then go talk to that vendor as well and make sure we collect all the data from them. And we'll do all that before we even start thinking about writing any code. And that's been really helpful, actually, because the biggest value add I've gotten from meeting with users of Sonar, I think, is just hearing what they're doing and seeing what they're doing. And you lose a lot. I mean, the bigger we get, the harder that is, right? There just isn't the time in the day to do it anymore. But I mean, he's already turned around a lot of really valuable stuff. And I mean, that's something that we're quickly seeing the value in and we'll keep doing. And there's other steps to it, right? But I think that's been a really good one for us to make sure that at the minimum we're capturing all the requirements, if nothing else. But it's given us a lot more than that already.
You know, a fear is potentially that while you continue to try to match feature parity from version one, that potentially competitors begin to add feature sets that you guys don't have yet. And is he helping to kind of satisfy that? And how is the framework of version two going to help you quickly add things like, you know, putting in TR69 support or improved radius support and being able to add features quickly without having to kind of go back and rewrite things from the bottom up?
Yeah.
So you can catch back up again if it looks like you're falling behind some of the other vendors.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the way we've looked at this internally is that I'm not super worried about falling behind. I mean, we've never really built Sonar with a concern too much about what everyone else is doing. I think you're challenged in running a business, no matter what it is, if your primary concern is keeping up with the Joneses, right? Like you're ending up chasing other people all the time. But I get your point. I mean, if there's something important that people need and we don't have it and everyone else does it, you know, that's a problem. So he's helping with that to some degree in that there's features we're looking at implementing once we get the parity completed that he's already out there gathering data on and talking to vendors, talking to users, all that kind of thing so that we're ready for it. But I mean, that's really why we started building V2, was to make sure we were able to integrate new features more quickly and really in a more scalable way. And something that is a common issue for us in V1 is the bigger customers we have that are using it do frequently run into scaling issues. I mean, we have a big WISP on V1 who's got, as I remember, like 300-400 something microticks all tied into it at the same time. And they're, I mean, always running into issues with queues backing up and things aren't being executed quickly enough. And it's just part of the challenge of the deployment method that we had for V1. And so those kinds of things are a lot of the reason that we built V2, as well as having a much stronger API to be able to enable other integrations and that kind of thing. And I think one of the things that people have said to me when I say things like that is, you know, well, you don't necessarily care about the small ISPs, right? That's a big ISP problem and it doesn't affect me. But I mean, our belief, honestly, is that the vast majority of our customers and the people that are using Sonar Day want to be a big ISP. They're growing that way. And the stuff that we do to make things work well for a bigger ISP, I mean, it all trickles down.
Yeah.
Looking at V2 and reporting as an example, right? I mean, a lot of why we looked at integrating Looker and doing this much more complex reporting was to meet the needs of bigger guys. But I mean, it's certainly a helpful and useful tool for smaller WISPs as well. So anyway, that's sort of our approach with that kind of stuff.
Cool. So I'm curious about, what is something that's coming up, something you're just working on that actually excites you? Because I know whatever you're working on, big projects, most of it becomes a grind, and it's sort of hard sometimes to find those little things that excite you. I'm just curious what that might be for you at this point.
See, you're very skilled at asking questions of people in a way that they'll give you an answer. Like if you'd said to me, what's the next big secret thing you're working on? I would have said, oh, I can't tell you, but ask me what I'm excited about working on. I might slip, right? No,
I don't know what you're talking about.
Talk about it. Yeah. What's exciting to me generally, and I'll give you some specifics here in a minute, but what's exciting to me generally is trying to solve problems that I don't think have been solved well, or solving them in a novel way. That's what's interesting to me. Like just knocking out the same stuff that everyone else is doing, or just filling in the gaps, I don't find very interesting personally. I mean, it's what we have to do a lot of the time. It's part of building software. But the stuff that gets me excited is finding those novel solutions. And then really what I love doing is pulling together other vendors or ISPs or whatever in the industry that were creating the solution that helps multiple people. And so the one that's actually excited me the most recently, and we've been working on this for a very long time now, on and off, but the relationship that we built up with Facebook, I don't know if how much I've talked about this publicly already, so maybe some of this is new, but we built up a relationship with Facebook because they have this thing called Facebook Connectivity, where they're trying to help ISPs around the world bring service to unserved communities. It's pretty similar to Microsoft Airband, but their approach is very different in that the Airband approach has been a lot about legislation or investment. The Facebook approach has really been about building open source software and hardware and giving it away to people to build ISPs where they couldn't otherwise afford it. And one of the things they built is a platform called Magma, which is a open source LTE core and EPC, where part of it runs in the cloud and then part of it runs on the prem. And it's a really cool system, but it's challenging to deploy and manage. You know, it's built by developers for developers, right? Was at least how it first came together. But I mean, I thought this was a really exciting thing because I know the state of LTE in the WISP industry was pretty choppy. You know, there's some good hardware out there, but a lot of the core stuff, naming no names, is not super stable. And so I thought this would be great for people who want to deploy LTE. We've been working on it for a while, but we got Microsoft to sort of jump in as part of Airband, and they made some modifications to it to get it working on Azure. And I've been working with some of the LTE vendors, and they're working on the local EPC part of it. And I mean, that's something I'm really looking forward to getting out there. And I think what's exciting to me there is just getting all these people pulling in the same direction, right? Like Facebook's excited that we're helping get it out there. Some of these LTE vendors are excited we're going to make it easier for people to deploy that gear. I'm excited we're going to be able to give people access to a cloud-hosted EPC to hopefully get rid of the one there they don't like. And, you know, and that's pretty cool. The other stuff really that gets me excited is, you know, building something new that we don't have today, not adding another integration with another inline device or whatever, but building some big, exciting, complicated thing that is going to give people a new avenue to help the customers or make more money or, you know, do something cool or whatever it might be. And I think the next one probably will help me to this because I don't have the roadmap in front of me, but I think the next one we'll have coming out will be the Twilio integration that we've rebuilt. Now, we kind of had this in V1 where you could tie in your own Twilio account to do SMS to your staff, but we actually went out and bought a short code from Twilio, so like one of those 5-digit codes, which are ridiculously expensive, but they let you send a lot higher quantity and not get blocked and that kind of thing. And so we're going to be enabling that so people can send text messages to their customers, but do it through our short code. And that's pretty cool. Like from a technological perspective, that's been pretty interesting. But yeah, that's the kind of stuff I get into, is more just pulling companies together, whether it's vendors, ISPs. I like those things where I got a kind of a group of people working towards a common goal. It's, I think, it's good validation as well that you're doing something that makes sense.
That's cool. So you said all, there was a lot in that statement. One of the things that you, you said you'd like to solve things in a novel way. Is there something that to the casual user, it's like one button, one click, but on the back end, you actually did some crazy kung fu that's really awesome that nobody will ever know about?
Yeah, tons of stuff. I think, I mean, we're doing that every day, really. I think the sort of running joke for most people at work on big pieces of software is, you know, behind the scenes, people are running around doing all this stuff every day to keep it up and running, right? There's a lot of complexity and a lot of stuff nowadays. I think, you know, the thing I'm probably the most proud of in what we've built in V2 at least, which probably not super exciting to some people, but is pretty exciting to me, is the API. That was a huge challenge to get that all working. And I don't know how much you guys all know about the API in V2, but it's built around this technology called GraphQL, just something Facebook came up with. And it's very different than the normal REST API in that instead of saying, like in a typical API, you might say, I want data on account ID 1, or I want data on account ID 2, or I want all accounts. But if what you really want to get is every account that's in Wisconsin that owes more than $50 and has a automatic credit card on their account and a Cambium radio, you really can't query something like that from most APIs. It's just not feasible. You got to fetch all the data and then filter it yourself. And so with this GraphQL API, you can load all that related data in one request, but you can also query by doing a partial text search or some kind of mathematical equation, or, I mean, the sky's the limit, really. It's actually, that API is what drives all of V2. Like, we're using that to build the app as well. And, I mean, maybe people don't look at it and think, it's just click one button and it works, but I think people look at it and think, you know, it's an API, and it was, I mean, months and months of us banging our head, figuring out how to make it all work. And that's pretty exciting, I think, because to me, us having a good API is one of the core things that doesn't keep our users trapped into having to do what they're told by the software they're using, right? You know, if you have an API where you can do everything, if you have some great business idea and you want to deploy, you know, some service or some product or do something in some special way, you can do it, right? You might have to write some code, interface to the API and do it, but you can do it. There's nothing that's in your way. And I actually had a call with a customer of ours a couple of weeks ago where they built, the whole ISP really is built around self-service. So every customer they have signs up online, picks a service, schedules their installation. They built a mobile app for it, a web portal, I mean, all this crazy stuff. And they built all of that around the Sonar API. And that, you know, seeing stuff like that to me is really exciting because it shows sky's the limit, really, when you utilize something like that. But I'd say otherwise to me, I mean, I'm a back-end dev really more than anything else. So I look at a lot of the infrastructure that we have and a lot of the things we're doing to make Sonar scale. And that's kind of, you know, the exciting stuff to me and the stuff I think people don't really see, right? You use a web app and it either works or it doesn't. As long as it works, you're just happy with it. I guess much like Netflix, you stream a movie and it starts right away, you're happy. But under the hood, there's a lot of crazy stuff going on to make that work. I guess true of ISPs, really, right? Your customers get online, they're happy. If they can't, they don't. And they're not really thinking about OSPF and EGP and, you know, RF and ducting and everything else.
That stuff, I love hearing about, like you said, the novel ways people solve those things. It's like magicians, you know, they pull your card out of the deck. But sometimes if you were to actually see the other side of the table, some of the stuff they do is so complex and so precise, and they've practiced it for so many hours to do that one simple thing. So it looks like just such a little thing to you, but on the back end, there's all this crazy kung fu that goes into it. And that's what excites me. I love seeing that stuff.
Yeah, it's actually why I like watching Penn and Teller, because they'll do a magic trick and you see it and think, holy cow, that was amazing. And then they'll do it and show you how they did it.
Yeah.
And you're almost more amazed, because some of the things they do, they're not really tricks. You know, they're really just doing, I think when I don't remember if it was them that said it or another magician, but I remember some magician I was watching saying that the way to do a really good trick is figure out a way to do it and then just get it done, right? And even if the way you do it is the first way people would think to do it, if they then immediately think, well, there's no way they're doing it that way, because Christ, that would have taken them years of practicing or whatever, then, you know, it's almost a more amazing trick by doing that. And yeah, it's, but under all that, for all of us in the technology industry, right, it's what people really see is, does it work or not? And a million times it does work, you don't really remember, but, you know, it's how this industry goes.
Yeah, for sure. Teller has one of my favorite lines. He says, magic is practicing something way more than anybody would reasonably expect you to.
Yes. So you said it a lot more eloquently than I was trying to say, but
yeah, there's a lot of wisdom in that stuff. Maybe a little bit of madness too. You know, it is what it is. Yeah. So I was curious, you were talking about, you know, the Facebook pulling you into this, the Magma LTE Core, that project, and then maybe do a little bit with Microsoft. How'd you get introduced to that? How do you, this guy over here with Sonar, get introduced to a couple of the largest corporations on the planet?
Yeah, it's pretty weird. To be honest, I figured it was a bunch of BS when it started, because I thought, you know, what the hell's Microsoft going to give a damn about what we're doing, or, you know, what will Facebook care? But what I've learned with those companies is they're so big. I mean, they're so unbelievably big, like so far beyond what I could even comprehend, that there's basically companies running inside those companies, right? That are groups of people doing things. And some of the people that are in those sort of internal companies are guys that worked at startups or only have one very particular set of interests. And I think in both cases, both us teaming up with Microsoft and Facebook, there was a person or a group of people there that have been watching what we were doing with Sonar because they had a passion for the ISP industry. And I think in both of those cases, Microsoft and Facebook are more focused really on outside of North America and Europe, right? They're mostly looking at like Africa, India, places like that. But again, I think solving problems for an ISP in India, I mean, a lot of those solutions help ISPs in North America. And I think that's kind of where we're bridging the gap, is helping bring some of those things back over here where the attention's not being focused. But anyway, like the initial meeting with them, it was really just talking to somebody there who was super passionate about what they were trying to do and what we were doing. And it's all pretty loose, really. It's just like, how can we help each other? And I think that's that's how we've been able to tell when we've found a good path to go down or a good way forward is it doesn't really feel like we're bending over backwards to help them or vice versa, right? It's clearly a good path for both of us. But yeah, it's weird, man. I like been to Microsoft events now and been to Facebook events and stuff, and it's just feels very peculiar, but started to get used to it. But it's exciting in a way. You know, I think there's some fear of these quote-unquote big corporations coming in, but you know, they're doing some pretty cool stuff. I mean, they're really driven to get internet access to people that don't have access to it today, and I think that's a pretty good goal.
Yeah, for sure. But I you know, I would challenge you and say that everybody who's going to listen to this is probably in that same boat, right? Trying to get internet to.
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. But I think, you know, the way I've been looking at this with them is that they're not coming in to compete with everyone listening to this. They're coming in and they're willing to help. I mean, there's a bunch of WISPs that are members of Airband that Microsoft's invested in or given them help in some kind of way. And they're, you know, they're not looking. It's not like Elon Musk, right? Microsoft's not looking to put satellites in orbit. They're looking to help people that are already building ISPs to right. build them bigger and better. And yeah, and I mean, you could look at cynically and say, yeah, I guess, you know, it's good for Microsoft to get more people on the internet. It's good for Facebook to get more people on the internet.
Well, but for sure.
Who cares, right? You know, I mean, if they're getting people on there and they're not getting in everyone else's way, I think it's win-win, really.
This may be a cynical way of looking at it, but I believe there's no such thing as altruism, or there's no such thing as, a completely selfless act. I think if I do something good for somebody else and it truly helps them, it makes me feel good, right? But in my opinion, that's a win-win. So is that really a bad thing that I get something out of it, that I get, you know, the satisfaction of helping others? I think that's okay.
Yeah. If that's all you're getting, you probably get tired of it after a while. But yeah,
it's pretty
good
draining.
In the beginning. I think, I don't know if I'd agree completely. I think there is such a thing as altruism. I mean, I think there are some people out there that are doing nothing really but helping others. But I think for that to be your only drive is few and far between. And I think, you know, I might help you one time, right? Because you need it and that's all I'm getting out of it. But I think from a business perspective, it's better for a business to have some kind of benefit in mind, right? And I think that's why I like pulling all these businesses together, whether it's vendors, other ISPs, and both, is because then you're not asking someone to do you a favor, right? You're all getting something out of it, whatever that may be. And I think that just drives a lot more passion and excitement about things than, yeah, okay, I'll help you out. Like if a guy asked me to help him move, I mean, I'll probably do it, but I'm not. It's not that exciting, right? But if we're both setting up a new business together of some kind and we're going to go work all night on get building up and running or whatever, then it's the same kind of work, but there's definitely a different motivating factor underlying what we're doing.
Does that scratch some kind of itch in your brain, pulling together those large organizations and moving something forward?
A bit, yeah. I think it does in the sense that what I like in doing things is seeing people, I was going to say see value in it, but I don't think see value is the right word. I like seeing people excited about stuff. You know, I like seeing people, you know, excited and interested. And the core of most of the stuff that I do personally is about creating things. Like, that's what I like, right? Even in my personal life, I'm just creating stuff all the time. It's just what I've learned. The older I get, you know, it's what keeps me sane. And I think the thing with creating stuff is at some point you want to show it to people, or you want people to be involved, right? Nobody wants to just make things in the dark and then throw them away. And so, yeah, pulling vendors together and pulling people up, you know, just pulling people together in general, I think being part of an active creation of some kind where the people involved in it are all getting some kind of positive emotional response out of it. Yeah, it's a fulfilling thing to do.
Something I've heard is that artists make art for it to be seen.
Yeah.
They don't make it to, you know, throw it in the closet and lock it away.
But I think that's true of anybody making anything. I mean, ISP operators don't build networks for nobody to use them, right? Like, if you're making something, you want people to get some value out of it or some joy out of it or whatever, right? It's what drives everyone, I think.
That's interesting. Well, I'll tell you what, we're closing in on an hour, which is about where people, completely fall asleep. So I wanted to ask Chad and Mike if they had any kind of outstanding questions that we didn't touch on. I know there was a lot of questions and obviously not a lot of time to get it all in. But did you guys have anything burning a hole in your pockets you really needed to get out there into the world?
I like the wrap up there about giving back to the community and tie that back into the API. And every time I see you and your staff talk about the API and the solutions that your customers and vendors are coming up with that, you guys all light up about that. And they're out there solving the same problems I have and the same problems Mike mm-hmm. has. And I'd love a forum or a place where I can go see, all right, if I need to integrate something, someone else has already solved this for me. How can I get involved and get in touch with that person or that company that's already fixed this and throw them some bones or learn from them, and so that we're not all reinventing the wheel every time we go try to solve a problem. But there's a community of people out there that have already done this with Sonar and the new API that are sharing that knowledge.
Yeah, I would love to see that too. And I think the challenge that I've seen with it is kind of around the same thing I mentioned earlier, when people are building software in-house and it's not necessarily a good fit for everyone else. A lot of the stuff I've seen built that's been cool is sort of built and then forgotten, right? It's built to solve a problem and then there's nobody there to maintain it, or they're not continuing to maintain it and build on it and support it and that kind of thing. And it's just often challenging to pick up a piece of software somebody's built and take it on and keep it running and make it work. That being said, I mean, I've always hoped there'd be some kind of community springing up around that in the API. And there's been quite a few people that have approached me about, would we have an issue if they sold the stuff they've been building to integrate with Sonar, or do we care if they make it open source or whatever? And I mean, I'd love to see it. I'd love to see more of it, but it's tricky. I mean, it's a big thing to take on, to put something out there and then, support it for people. But I think where I'd like to see us go in the future, and I think we've made some progress towards that with building the open source customer portal and that kind of thing. I'd like us, Sonar, to be putting more things out there, even if it's just a skeleton of something that people can build on, but a foundation that people can take to at least get started on something. And I'd like to see that, sooner than later. We've talked quite a bit about doing things like Zapier integrations and stuff like that too, as just a kind of springboard to make stuff easier for people. But like everything, it's figuring out where to fit on the roadmap.
Yep.
But yeah, I mean, if there's something that we can do to help grow that more, I mean, I'm all ears. I'd love to, because it's something I'd really like to see.
Yeah. To Chad's point, the API, every time I hear somebody talking about API first, I get excited, because, Ansible is what I eat, sleep, breathe, repeat these days. And so it opens up all these interesting, my brain starts building these Rube Goldbergs of automation where I could do all kinds of interesting things. So I'm definitely on board with that.
And whereas I'm basically the opposite. API, don't care. I'm not gonna I'm not gonna spend the time to figure that out. Find me someone to make it happen, because I'm never gonna do it.
That's the good thing, right? You can find someone to make it happen, whereas if it didn't exist, you can't even do that. And I think that's what I try and press on people a lot with it, is it's not about, I don't want you to learn to program, right? That's not the point. It's about not constraining you by not even having it available. But yeah, I follow you. And that's why I also hate when anyone inside Sonar brings that as a solution, well, people can just tie into the API. I'm like, they can, yeah, but we still need to be building features. That shouldn't be our answer to anything other than it's there for you, and you know that's an option that you have. But yeah, I never wanted to be the answer to how do I X. Well, hopefully, we'll eventually provide tools for X for everyone, but it's going to be a while yet.
Right, it's good to hear you say that, though. That the API is not the answer; that it's a piece of the solution.
Yeah, it's a tool, right? I mean, yeah. I think because, and I had this discussion inside the company a bunch of times. By that logic, reductively, we should just provide an API and build nothing else, right?
Like, right.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Mike, any final questions, any thoughts?
No, I talked a lot less than I thought I would, which probably makes Simon happy.
Yeah, I always talk a lot more than I probably should, so I've probably taken all the time up, but yeah.
All right, well, let's stick a fork in it. Mikey, if folks out on the internet want to get a hold of you, how would you prefer them to do that?
Patreon.com/BrothersWisp, and someone else can help you.
You know, you say that every single time, and what's funny is you are usually the very first person to respond to anyone's question on the Slack channel. It's you're almost always immediately in there, so...
Especially
well,
if
that,
it's
that's not reality.
Anywhere near troll related. Yeah, Mike's going to be the first one on right. that. So. Yeah. All right, Chad. Yeah, I would ask you the exact same thing.
And I would give almost the same answer, except I'm happy to receive email as well if you hit me up at chad@auwireless.net or the Slack channel works real well too.
Excellent. Well, Simon, if you wanted folks to interact with you in some fashion, how would you have them do that?
Well, easy way, I think, is probably email simon@sonar.software. But I'm happy to receive letters, carrier pigeons, you know, whatever.
Smoke signals?
Yeah. Well, it's probably tough over distance, but yeah, yeah. Email works.
We're pretty good at those in Colorado, though. I can send those.
Yes. Yeah, I can probably see those from here if I go outside, but it's like minus 15 here today, so I probably
won't. Are you talking about the kind that make you have the munchies, Chad, that make you really tired? Is that where we're at?
No comment.
In the conversation? All right. So also, you heard Simon. He mentioned it, sonar.software. Go check those guys out. Mike, Chad, and especially Simon, thank you guys for joining us today. And
thank you.
Hopefully you guys enjoy this. If you have any questions or comments, you can hit us at contact@thebrotherswisp. Oh, yeah, you can find me at greg@gregsoul.com, where I very regularly blog. You can also find me in the Little Brothers Wisp Slack. It's patreon.com/Brothers Wisp. You get an invite in there with a whole lot of smart guys, way smarter than me.
Well, and me. I mean, don't leave me out. That's not fair.
All right. So thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next time. Now I hit stop on all the recordings. Come over here, and I say stop. Don't close your browser. Just know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry. You're forgiven.